Move to the second case this morning, UAL Corporation versus RayGen Capital. Rubin.
Good morning. May it please the court, I am Paul Rubin, counsel for appellant, RayGen Capital One Incorporated. In a nutshell, our position is that RayGen is the holder of a valid cure claim assigned by AT&T because United assumed the contracts with AT&T under the confirmed bankruptcy plan, and that United has wrongfully refused to pay this valid claim. There is a fundamental principle of contract law that the assignee of a claim stands in the shoes of the assignor as an entitled to enforce that claim. Before this case, we have not been able to find any decision whatsoever by any court holding that in order to collect a cure claim, the assignee of that claim must also take an assignment of the rights of the assignor under the contract underlying that claim. There simply is no such principle, and we don't think that one should be invented. We respectfully submit that the cure claim does not magically disappear simply because the original holder of that claim has assigned it, because to do so would be to confer upon the debtor an unfair windfall, which is what this court has said in older prior decisions, the Lorraine Hotel case from 1945 and the Copley case from 1993. The assignee stands in the shoes of the assignor. And in fact, the debtor is not harmed by the assignment because all it has to do is write the check to a different address. It is not changed in any way. I'd also like to point out that in the statute that is in play here, which is section 365B1A of the bankruptcy code, there is no limitation upon the right of the there's no limitation upon who has the right to collect the cure claim. In contrast, for example, in 365B1B, which is the very next provision, one of the other conditions to assumption of an executory contract, the code provides that the debtor or the bankruptcy trustee assuming a contract must compensate or provide adequate assurance of a prompt compensation to whom? To the party other than the debtor to the contract. That is specific. So, for example, if there's a right to attorney's fees, that is a right for actual pecuniary loss suffered as a result of the breach. There, the right to collect for that loss is limited by the bankruptcy code only to the party to the contract. But there is no similar limitation here with regard to B1A. And this case is very similar to the same facts we had where I was representing RayGen before the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. In that case, that was the U.S. wireless data case. In that case, again, AT&T assigned to us, to our client, RayGen Capital, a pre-petition general unsecured claim. The debtor went ahead and it assumed its contracts with AT&T. Same assignor, same assignee, same exact contract. And in that case, unfortunately for us, AT&T missed the cure claims bar date. That was a case where general unsecured creditors were getting paid, and even equity in that case was getting money. So we said to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, please, we admit that we missed the cure claim bar date. Our assignor did it, and we stand in the shoes of our assignor. But please, at least allow us to collect it as a general unsecured claim, because after all, this claim began as a general unsecured claim. And the Second Circuit said to us, no, it's true that your claim started as a general unsecured claim, but it falls into the more narrow category of cure claims, and therefore you only have a cure claim. Forgive us for feeling that we're damned if we do or we're damned if we don't, but here the courts are telling us you only have a general unsecured claim. You don't have a cure claim. We think that is wrong. It's inventing a rule that's contrary to the common law and contrary to the language in the bankruptcy code. The Second Circuit and also the Fourth Circuit in the Adventures case specifically said that when you have an assumption of an executory contract, the pre-petition claim is transformed. It's the very same claim. So when the bankruptcy court and the district court said, no, you only had a general unsecured claim, we believed that they committed error. The second point I'd like to address is the issue as to whether United assumed the AT&T contracts and also whether the belated June 2008 rejection somehow eviscerated or annulled the prior assumption. The bankruptcy court held here that every single one of the assumptions of executory contracts under this plan of reorganization was conditional. And we believe there are many reasons why we can prove to you why it was not conditional. For example, one of the main contracts here that was assumed by the debtors.
Did United ever agree in writing to the amount of the cure?
No, they didn't. But actually,
so
I apologize.
Was that one of?
I apologize. I misspoke. Let me start over. I apologize. When this claim was objected to, this claim was originally filed. There were two objections where United reviewed this claim. They filed omnibus objections in the summer of 2005, and there are two orders in the record that I can point you to where they recognized Region as the assignee of this claim. If you look at page A52 in the record, there's an order where United objected and said that they thoroughly reviewed their books and records. And they said the claim was filed for $5,423,898, and they said based upon their review of the books and records, this claim should be reduced, and the proper amount is $4,898,728. They reviewed their books and records, and they knew the pricing. Somehow, they did the research to be able to figure out the precise amount of this very same claim. And then they filed another objection, and they said, we've determined the holder of this, the entity who's liable on this claim, is not UAL. You filed it against the wrong entity. We want it reclassified. And the bankruptcy court at A76 in the record entered a second order and said the entity who's liable on this claim is United Airlines, Inc. So there has been a substantive review of this claim. And the cure claim that was filed specifically references that claim. The original cure claim is on page 146 of the record, and it specifically references claim 43490. It's the exact same claim that they reviewed. And when they objected to this claim, to the cure claim, which we filed in March of 06, they waited until October of 07 to object to the cure claim. And what did they say? Did they say it's the wrong amount? No. All they said is it does not appear in our books and records. Well, of course, no cure claim appears in the books as records as such. It began as the general unsecured claim, and we proved that it was the same claim. And therefore, when we came forward with our response, in June of 08, they suddenly entered upon a new tack, and they said, guess what? We have decided to reject the contract. But nowhere in the plan is there any statement that the rejection of the contract eviscerates the prior assumption. The plan of reorganization.
Mr. Rubin, let me ask you some basic questions here. Okay?
Sure.
As I understand it, Section 365 of the code requires court approval for an assumption to be effective.
And you have that.
Do you agree with that?
I agree with that. And that happened.
You're not trying to rely on assumption by conduct or implied.
No, it's
assumption.
In the plan. I'll show you the pages in the plan, Your
okay,
Honor.
Right. It's in the plan. But the plan also has this provision for 15 days to reject, correct?
There is a provision that says that they do reserve the right to reject, but there's nothing in the plan that says that the rejection nullifies the prior assumption. And the bankruptcy code, and this is very important, Your Honor, in 365 G2A, again, that's 365 G2A, the bankruptcy code specifically contemplates this exact situation where the debtor assumes a contract, and we have this, by the way, on page one of our addendum right after our reply brief. The text is there. Where the contract has been assumed under a plan that's confirmed, which is exactly what happened here, and then they decide to reject it. And when is that deemed rejected? It's deemed to take a breach. When is the breach or rejection deemed to occur? As of the date of the rejection, meaning in June of 08. Not a rejection that brings it back to the petition date so that all the claims are pre-petition. There's nothing in the bankruptcy code that says that a post-assumption rejection eviscerates the prior assumption. Like, for example, there's a famous case in the Second Circuit called Kleinsleep, which is in our brief, where, and this was before amendments to the bankruptcy code, where the debtor made an improvident assumption. They assumed the contract and they said, oops, we goofed. We never should have done that. And they tried to reject. And the Second Circuit said, that's all administrative. All the claims up to that date of that subsequent rejection are administrative. Now, if I may, in this plan, there are specific provisions for conditional assumption in limited circumstances. Pages 136 and 138 and 139 of the record. In 136 and 138 and 139, the debtor specifically tells us that there are specific identified contracts, leases at airport terminals, where the assumption is conditional, and they even set forth the conditions under which that assumption will become final. But when you look to the assumption of those on Schedule 3, there is no such limitation or restriction or specification. And in A141, which is the provision that talks about rejection that Judge Hamilton, you had mentioned, there in particular, the first sentence of that paragraph talks about the debtors objecting to a cure under an executory contract that is assumed, that in that event, the bankruptcy court shall determine the allowed amount of such cure. It doesn't talk about a conditionally assumed contract or a provisionally assumed contract.
Right. I understood the bankruptcy court to have said, in essence, that this paragraph, and I'm looking at page A141 of the appendix you submitted, is the basis upon which it allowed UAL to refuse to pay the cure.
That is correct. I looked at that one last sentence.
Okay. I'm not expressing any opinion about whether that provision is or is not compatible with the rest of bankruptcy law, but it is part of the plan that was approved and your client signed off on.
But it's
right?
not compatible. The holding by the bankruptcy judge is not compatible with other provisions of this very same plan, is what I'm saying, because the plan says specifically that all of the assumptions are effective as of the effective date. Please look at page 140, paragraph I. Page 140, paragraph I, the very first sentence, entry of the confirmation order by the bankruptcy court shall constitute approval of the assumption or conditional assumption of the executory contracts to be assumed under the plan as of the effective date. There already was an assumption as of the effective date. And there's another sentence I can show you as well, back on page 133 of this very same plan. On page 133, which is the beginning of Article 7 of the plan, it specifically says in the third line of that paragraph, the first paragraph of Article 7, confirmation of the plan shall constitute the bankruptcy court's approval of the proposed treatment of executory contracts and unexpired leases, as set forth below, and determination that the debtors have exercised reasonable business judgment in determining whether to assume or reject their executory contracts. It's right there in the plan. And what is the schedule? What is the title of Exhibit 3? Schedule 3 shows up four times in the record. And the name of that title is Assumed Executory Contracts. And that's it. And I'll give you the citations at 150 of the record, at 367, at 364, and again at 425. I know I said that quickly. I apologize. 150, 367, 364, and 425. And one of those schedules was filed when? After we filed the cure claim. There was no unfair surprise. March 2, 2006, we filed that claim. And simply 2 weeks later, they filed another schedule. I would like to point out also just the problem of the interpretation that the bankruptcy court used basically says that they can come for advisory opinions, that they can wait as long as they want.
Well, I understand that's your objection, but the question is whether that's what the plan provided.
Nowhere does it say here that there's a rejection, but nowhere does it say that the rejection annuls the prior assumption. We have specific rights under the bankruptcy code to collect a cure claim, like in the USN Communications case where the original holder of the claim no longer even was a party to the contract. And the court said in that case specifically that the that the assignee has the right to collect. There's no limitation in 365b1 only to the holder, the original party to the contract.
Yeah, but the rejection provision, though, that is in the plan, if I understand this correctly, is basically intended to allow the debtor to say, no, wait a minute, that cure is too expensive. We don't want it.
Well, I don't know.
And because under your interpretation, there's no point in rejection. There's no benefit to the debtor.
That's not true at
they're
all, Your Honor.
They're still stuck with the cure amount, right?
They're stuck with the cure amount, but you know what rejection does? It says, I don't have to perform any more in the future. It's an efficient breach of a contract. A party can't come into court. As this court said in a case in 2008 called Madiglia, I can give you the citation, this court said the rejection allows them to avoid specific performance. There is a benefit to the debtor. But if they wanted to take away my statutory right, they're supposed to say it specifically, because there's no way I could know by looking at this plan. It's their subjective intent, and subjective intent does not take away the statutory right of a creditor, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Rubin. Mr. Slade.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. I'm Mike Slade, and I represent United Airlines and its affiliated debtors. I want to start by saying that the decisions below should be affirmed because the lower courts correctly interpreted the contract between Regent and AT&T, applied Section 365 of the Bankruptcy Code, and enforced our confirmed plan of reorganization. I'm going to go in that order because I think it makes the most sense, but I want to stress at the beginning that he's got to win on all three issues to achieve remand here. And the last issue, the plan issue that Judge Hamilton's been focused on, might be the easiest one. I'm not sure that there's a plausible reading of the plan other than the one we're offering and the one Judges Weedoff and Dara accepted. But perhaps the most telling fact here is that there was litigation about what this specific provision of the plan meant prior to plan confirmation. And the parties to that litigation disagreed on many things. They disagreed on whether the plan was appropriate under 365. They disagreed about whether it satisfied 1129 of the Bankruptcy Code. But all of the parties agreed on what the plan meant. And all of the parties agreed that the plan meant exactly what I'm telling you it means today, that United has the opportunity to litigate cure disputes, and if it doesn't like the result, United can reject with no consequence. I don't think their reading of the plan makes any sense, and we're going to get to that in some more detail. But I wanted to emphasize right at the outset that even if my very able opponent is able to get over the other hurdles that were present here, he has to convince the panel that the reading of Judge Weedoff, Judge Dara, United, and the other parties pre-confirmation, including one of the parties represented by the same firm as his co-counsel, is an abuse of discretion. And I don't think he's going to get there. But I want to start with the contract issue. And the question here is, what does Regen own? What did they buy? And the answer here is that they bought the right to a distribution, if any, on a general unsecured pre-petition claim. The way Regen posits this is that what they bought was the pre-petition debt, the amount of money owed by United to AT&T as of the petition date. That's not what they bought. If they wanted to buy the pre-petition debt, it would have been very easy for them to do that. They didn't. Similarly, they do not purport to be the assignee of AT&T's right to payment under any of the contracts. If they wanted to get AT&T's right to payment from United under any of the contracts, it would be very easy for them to do that. The contract could have said that. It did not. So all of the cases they cite about account creditors, they just don't apply here because the language of this contract is very specific. Now, take a look at Exhibit C to the Regen AT&T contract, which is on page A36 of the record. That is a form document that AT&T and Regen are supposed to file with the bankruptcy court every time that a claim is assigned. So that is what AT&T and Regen are telling both the bankruptcy court and the debtor about what was transferred. And frankly, it would be the only way that United or any other debtor would know about what was transferred. It's very clear that what was sold there was a general pre-petition unsecured claim. And there would be no reason, for example, If United wanted to have negotiations about assuming or rejecting this contract, there were no reason for us to even consider talking to Regen about that, because all they owe is the right, if any, to a distribution on a general unsecured claim. Now, the
Mr. Slade, let me. I'm going to parse that language a little bit, and I'm going to delete some words, okay, so that it says that what was assigned includes any claims or rights of any nature whatsoever arising in connection with the claim. That sounds pretty broad to me.
Well, that's the we have to talk. I agree. I appreciate the parsing of the language. The question is, what arises out of the filing of the proof of claim?
Right. And suppose I was looking at this language not in the form in terms of an assignment, but let's say it was a discovery request. We want documents not only about your claim, but also about any claims or rights of any nature whatsoever arising in connection with the claim. I think I'd sure expect that to include documents about the cure.
But in the bankruptcy context, that wouldn't be an accurate assumption,
okay,
Your Honor.
Why not?
A couple reasons. First of all, United has to pay to assume these contracts. If it wants to assume, it's got to pay the cure, and it's totally irrelevant whether or not a proof of claim is on file. It's totally irrelevant. And on the other side of the coin is the second reason, which is the fact that they filed a pre-petition claim doesn't give them any rights to cure at all. If you're a debtor, if you're a contract counterparty, and a debtor wants to assume your contract, you can't say, oh, I have a proof of claim on file, a general unsecured proof of claim on file, so you have to pay a cure. That's not good enough. Federal Rule of Bankruptcy Procedure 6006 is very clear. You've got to file a separate request for cure. The two things are totally unrelated, and having one does not give you the right to the other. I mean, the proof is in the pudding here, Your Honor, because as Mr. Rubin said, that's exactly what Regen did. After the plan was filed, Regen didn't just say, oh, I have a proof of claim on, general unsecured proof of claim on file, so you have to pay me a cure. No, they filed, as they were required to under the applicable law, a separate claim, because one does not arise from the other. And that makes sense, Your Honor, because when you're making decisions about assumption and rejection of the contract, that relates to an ongoing business relationship between the two parties. There would be no reason, and frankly, there was no reason for United to have any discussions with Regen about assuming or rejecting the AT&T contracts. And what happened here, and why it took so long for the ultimate claim to be filed, because what happened? After the plan was confirmed, we made a distribution on the unsecured claim to Regen. So they already had $600,000 worth of United stock, because that was all United believed it owed Regen. And that's why Mr. Rubin says, when we first filed our objection to their cure claim, what we said was, we don't have anything on our books and records, because we didn't. We believed the claim had been entirely satisfied. So I want to take one question real quick, which was Judge Tinder's question of Mr. Rubin. Did we ever agree in writing to the amount of the cure? And the answer to that question is clearly and dispositively no. In fact, there is you could search the record in vain, and you will not find the indication of any cure amount for any of the individual contracts that are at issue here. It's just not in the record at all. And we certainly didn't agree to that. If you take a look at what the proof of claim is, that's the first document in the record starting at A2. What it is, it's a long list of something called account numbers and a long list of amounts allegedly owed. There's no connection in that document to any contracts. What the account numbers are probably invoices, right? There's no connection between those and individual contracts. And you cannot connect them up from this record. So to answer your question, there has clearly not been any agreement by United on what the cure amount would be for any individual contract, even if one was owed. So I'll turn to the next question, which is kind of it could be posed as an abstract question, which is, what does it mean to assume a contract? Your Honors are correct that you have to have court approval to assume a contract. And I guess the statutory question is, do you assume a contract in the abstract, and then you have to determine what's the cure amount, and then you pay it? Or do you determine what the cure amount is, and then you either assume the contract and either pay it or have a specific plan to pay it before a contract is deemed assumed? And under the statutes, 365b1, it's clearly the latter. The closest they come to saying when we said we would give adequate assurance, we would promptly cure, is the plan. But you can't read anything in the plan saying that we gave adequate assurance that we would pay any person any specific amount to cure at any time. And that clearly applies to Region, just like the other creditors. Exhibit 3 to the plan, which lists the assumed contracts that would be subject to the terms and conditions of the plan, it's several inches thick. There are thousands of contracts listed there. And the purpose of the provision is pretty clear. United was assuming thousands of contracts. It did not know what some of the contract counterparties were going to claim to be the cure. So the provisions in there gave United options. It's very clear.
Can I ask you, Mr. Slade, whether the plan as you interpret it, giving you this, tell us, you say to the court, you tell us how much we have to pay to cure if we assume, and then we'll decide if we're assuming or rejecting. Is that common?
Your Honor, it is. First of all, I would say that is the rule prior to plan confirmation, Federal Bankruptcy Procedure 6006. That's very clear. That's what you do. I mean, you file a motion, you say, I want to assume a contract. They come in under the rule and say, this is how much you have to cure, and then you decide. But are you asking me, if is it common to have that specific provision?
Well, I guess what I'm trying to understand is whether this feature of this plan is driven by the size and complexity of the UAL bankruptcy, or whether that would apply, whether the same thing would happen if a local dry cleaner goes into Chapter 11.
I think I would tell you my experience in this realm is not broad enough to really answer that question. It's probably not a very common provision. My understanding is that it was put in here specifically because United did not want to stay in bankruptcy for several more years while it figured out what to do with the thousands of contracts that were listed on Exhibit A to the plan. So my understanding is that it is not a horribly common provision in a plan, but I can't tell you dispositively, Your Honor. So I guess let's turn to the plan, which is their position here is that if a contract is listed on Exhibit 3 to the plan, it's just assumed, and we have to pay whatever is ultimately determined to be the cure, no matter how much that is. That's not what the plan says, and it can't be what the plan means. Article 7 of the plan is what talks about what happens with contracts that are subject to assumption or rejection as of confirmation. And there are some specific provisions in there for contracts that were in limbo at the time, like this court had in front of it a number of the municipal bond leases, and there was a question about whether or not they were contracts at all. So that there's specific provisions in Article 7 that were negotiated between us and the creditors about how to deal with them. Similarly, one of our unions, the flight attendants union, claimed that we could not assume their contract. So while that dispute was being negotiated, we had a specific provision in the plan on how to deal with that. Article 7, Section I, is the catch-all provision. That's the one we're dealing with here. I found it interesting that Mr. Rubin said he mentioned two provisions in the plan that he said dispositively means that we assumed these contracts. But this is what they say. They say, entry of the confirmation order shall constitute approval of the assumption or conditional assumption of the executory contracts and expired leases to be assumed under the plan as of the effective date. That's what the first one
says.
Where
are you reading from?
I'm reading from the first. Sorry, Your Honor. I'm reading I'm reading from my. It's the first sentence of Provision A. Provision I.
Okay,
entry of the confirmation order by the bankruptcy court shall constitute approval of the assumption or conditional assumption of the executory contracts and unexpired leases to be assumed under the plan as of the effective date. That's what that sentence says. And the second sentence that he read from earlier in Section 7 of the plan said that confirmation of the plan shall constitute, this is the within the first paragraph of Article 7, confirmation of the plan shall constitute the bankruptcy's approval of the proposed treatment of executory contracts and unexpired leases as set forth below. And the proposed treatment is described in detail that if there's a cure dispute, we have to go through the process. There's three specific sentences in Article 7I of the plan that are clearly applicable here and clearly require rejection of their position. The first sentence says that if there's a dispute about cure, cure shall occur as soon as reasonably practicable following the entry of a final order resolving the dispute and or approving the assumption. You can't read that sentence and say that it was the confirmation order that was the court order approving assumption with an undefined cure amount. That sentence clearly says that there's going to be litigation and there's going to be another final order, which is a defined term under the plan, before any plan, any cure amount, if any, is to be paid. That's the sentence that precedes the sentence specifically saying that United reserves the right to reject any contract at any time not later than 15 days after the bankruptcy court determines how much would be owed to cure. Now, that provision, just it could not be clearer in meaning or intent. United was not going to assume a two-inch thick stack of contracts, lists of contracts, and agree to pay the cure amount on all of them, regardless of what was owed. The plan gave United the option. You can assume and pay the cure, or you can reject and pay nothing.
What do you make, then, of the argument under 365G2? Where your opposing party is saying, you can reject it later under these circumstances, but it has only prospective effect, and you've got an administrative claim up to that point.
No, 365, what happens on 365G2 is if you assume and then reject, you've got to pay all the damages, prospective and post. And second of all, 365 does not apply here. After the plan is confirmed, what governs is the plan, not the pre-existing provisions of the bankruptcy code. This provision does not make any sense at all unless you read it the way that we read it and Judge Weedoff does it. That's a different argument, subtly, Your Honor, than the one they made in their brief. In their brief, they argue that the reason the provision's in there's one paragraph on page 22 of their reply brief. They say the reason that provision is in there is so that if you assume a contract and then you later decide to breach that, if you decide to reject it, then it's a rejection, it's a breach of that contract rather than the plan. And that argument just doesn't make any sense. If you assume a contract under a plan, and then after assumption you breach the contract, you've breached the contract, not the plan. So there's no independent meaning to this paragraph unless you interpret it as the way the two lower courts did, as the way we did, and as in the manner that was interpreted in the litigants prior to confirmation. The other argument they make is that we supposedly knew what the cure amount was. I already talked earlier that we didn't know, and neither of us could identify the specific cure amount owed on any of the individual contracts here. I don't think there is a cure amount owed on the overwhelming majority of them, to be honest with you, for a variety of different reasons that's not relevant here. There's clearly no agreement, and there was no knowledge about what the cure amount was. And I'm going to close, Your Honors, where I started, which is that last part of Article 7, Section I, which is that the reserved right to reject executory contracts does not apply to Sabre Incorporated. That is the clause, Judge Hamilton, that appears literally. It's a semicolon after the language. We reserve the right to, and it's our, quote, reserve right to reject executory contracts. I'm not sure how much clearer you can get than that. Does not apply to Sabre. And there's context for that, which is that Sabre was a creditor that had read the plan and filed an objection, and they made some of the arguments that Region made in their brief. They claim that that provision's illegal, that United shouldn't have the right to wait 2, 3, 5, 7 years after confirmation to make a decision on assumption rejection. And they made the similar arguments. They said it violated 365, 1129, and essentially every provision of the bankruptcy code. And we didn't think there was anything wrong with those provisions, quite honestly. But I'll tell you one thing, that they read it exactly right because that is exactly what the provision says, and it's exactly what it means. There's no basis for a finding that Judge Weedoff modified the plan when he gave us this right. What he clearly did was interpret and apply the plan language. Now, we've talked about this in our brief, that one of the firms that was representing that creditor is now representing Regen. And they are described in their pleading, Article 7, Section I, in exactly the same way I'm describing it to you now. I'm not saying that they're estopped, Your Honor. I'm not saying that they're doing anything wrong by making this argument. And counsel's making doing a great job representing his clients. But what I'm saying here is that the standard of review here is abuse of discretion. This is Judge Weedoff's bankruptcy plan. He has he was the one on the ground dealing with a throng of objections and interpreting the plan in a variety of contexts. And you can't credibly claim that Judge Weedoff's interpretation of the plan was an abuse of discretion when it's consistent with the plain language of the plan. It was the plan interpretation offered by United and every party to litigation that occurred prior to confirmation, including one in a pleading signed by the same law firm that now represents you. So Judge Weedoff's plan interpretation gets substantial deference under this court's prior case law, and in our view, it can't plausibly be overturned under these circumstances. Unless the panel has any further questions, I'm prepared to cede the rest of my time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rubin.
Thank you. How much time? 4 minutes, Mr. Rubin.
Very briefly, Your Honors. There's a misconception that a cure must be determined in order to have an assumption of an executory contract. That is not true. Section 365B1 says you can have cure or adequate assurance of future performance. That's what we had. The discussion with regard to paragraph I, where it talks about assumption or conditional assumption, my point was Judge Weedoff said all assumptions were conditional. And that's not true. There are specific provisions of conditional, but here we're talking about contracts that are assumed. And the paragraph on page 141 talks about an objection to a contract that is assumed. That sentence in the plan takes for granted that there's going to be litigation, perhaps, with regard to a contract that is already assumed. We were told that there's no other plausible reading. I don't think it's plausible to say that this paragraph eviscerates the law, the right to cure under 365B1 unless it's explicit. In Aerodym, this court specifically said that confirmation of a plan does not bar a party from coming back to the court and saying that we want to enforce the plan to get our mandatory statutory rights under the bankruptcy code. His reading suggests that they could agree in writing to the amount of the claim and then within two weeks say, oh, no, never mind, we'll reject. And that they could also come to this court and on numerous times for any and all contracts into the bankruptcy court and the district court for advisory opinions as to what the cure amount is. They knew the cure amount on March 2nd, 2006. The document says in the heading itself that it's a cure claim with regard to assumed contracts of AT&T, and 2 weeks later they kept it on the list. They never made a motion to vacate the order for an inadvertence or mistake. And when they objected to the claim in October of 2007 to the cure claim, they didn't say that they were rejecting it. They knew the amount of the claim, but they had contract 119287 in full force and effect. He never addressed that in his whole argument. He said, this is the master agreement on page 164 and 168 of the record. It talks about the extension post-confirmation. Their conduct shows. What does assumption mean? Assumption means you take the full benefits and burdens. Like the Fourth Circuit said, it's cum inare, citing to the Supreme Court's decision, the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Bill Disco. You get the burdens and the obligations. Why didn't they reject it in October of 07 if they didn't like the cure claim amount? Because they wanted the benefit of the contracts. And this is a case, as a bankruptcy regular, I can tell you this case is going to get national attention because you made me make a new rule. I think it would be a dangerous rule to give debtors a way to evade 365B1. It's a statutory right. Sabre was the only party who came up with this argument, and with all due respect, I don't think my choice of local counsel in the year 2008 should affect the interpretation of the plan in 2006. Only one party adopted this interpretation. Nobody else. There's nowhere in the record does it say that. With regard to the amount of the claim, this is what the litigation is. We didn't have to agree to the cure for there to be an assumption. That was not required. But clearly here, they didn't have to agree. They brought forth whatever objections they have. And they said on page 186 of the record that in June of 08, that their investigation was still in its early stages. If they have an objection to the claim, they should have come forward and told it to us. With regard to their argument that these are two different claims, well, two circuit courts of appeal have told us it's the same exact claim, it's just entitled to a higher priority. And therefore, I don't believe that that there's any reason to divorce either one of the two. With regard to their saying there's no connection between the claim and the contracts, there's a documented record going back to 1993 of these two parties doing business pursuant to these contracts. There is absolutely nothing in the record to show that they did any business whatsoever outside of those contracts. When they objected to the claims in the summer of 2007, they computed the claim to the amount, to the dollar, to the exact dollar. They knew the derivation of the claim, and we are here today on that objection. There's no need for a remand. If they had a basis to object to the validity of this claim, it was their job to come forward with it now. My time is up. Thank you very much.
Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.